Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. It gives me great pleasure tonight to introduce Ava Hoffman, a writer whose work I've admired for a very long time. Her work is ambitious, lyrical, deeply felt. For anyone who has studied issues about Polish-Jewish relations or the transmission of trauma post-Holocaust, her work is indispensable. She has studied psychoanalysis and has written and lectured internationally on issues of exile, memory, politics, and culture. She's a native of the beautiful city of Krakow, Poland, where she studied music intensively before emigrating in her teens to Canada and then to the United States. She received her PhD in English and American Literature from Harvard, and she worked as a senior editor at the New York Times, serving for a while as the newspaper's regular literary critic. She is the author of 5 works of nonfiction: Lost in Translation, Exit into History, Shtetl, After Such Knowledge, and Time, as well as 2 novels, The Secret and Appassionata. Her literary awards include the Guggenheim Fellowship, the Whiting Award, and an award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and she's currently a visiting professor at Hunter College, City University of New York. Please join me in welcoming Ava Hoffman to the LA Public Library. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for your generous introduction.
So, Ava, your book is so much fun. This book is called Time. It's part of the series from Picador of Big Ideas, Small Books, and that is exactly what it is. There are many big ideas in this book. And what I loved so much about reading your book was that it just made me think of so many different, what you made me think of, so all the different ways that time operates on us, through us, with us. And I thought we would just start by just thinking about the here and now. What are some of the ways in which time, in a sense, is operating on us now? How many time zones did you travel to get here?
I've stopped counting. It must be said that one of the impelling impulses for me behind writing this book was precisely to think about what is happening to time now, to time in our time. And it seems to me that time is changing in astonishing and quite radical ways. And that some of the ways in which we manipulate time would have belonged to the realm of science fiction until only recently. And we're manipulating time, I think, in 2 directions, in the direction of extension and in the direction of compression. I mean, on the one hand, we're lengthening human lifespan to hitherto unprecedented length, and experimental sort of biological and biotechnological techniques like stem cell rejuvenation or the growth of organs in laboratory conditions, all of these things, you know, promise the extension of lifespan even further. There is an entirely new field called synthetic biology, which promises to tackle aging at its very root, at the level of the cell. So, you know, serious scientists are talking about extending lifespan to 200 years. Some perfectly serious scientists are asking whether death is necessary. Now, you know, whether that sort of, you know, extension is desirable or not is another question. Whether we would ever want to do away with mortality is yet another question. But you know, this is one thing that is happening. And then in the other direction, we're compressing time into fantastically minuscule units in our digital technologies, above all.
And we'll want to talk about that in a number of different ways, because you take it through various, through the body and through its effect on the mind. But you also said that your goal was in this book was to find out if one can become more intimate with time. And I thought that was quite beautiful. And how did you mean that?
Well, time is kind of, you know, our kind of great given, the great given of our existence. And it is difficult to come to terms with it often, with the kind of inevitable passage of time, the inevitable movement of time from birth to death. And yet we have to reckon with it. We have to think about it. We have to, I think, you know, accept it in order actually to live more fully in time, to use time more fully.
Well, you grew up in Poland. You were born just right after the war. And you start your meditation on time really talking about how time was, your sense of time was different in your childhood in Poland from when you came to the United States. Could you talk about that a little bit?
The post-war Poland in which I grew up was, comparatively speaking, the land of slow time. And I don't think this is only childhood nostalgia. I mean, we all remember childhood as a period of kind of, you know, slow, stretchy time. But I don't think this was only that. I think there were other factors as well. On the sort of, you know, quite negative side of it, Poland was a society in a state of arrest, in a state of economic stasis. And so, you know, there were no great incentives to work hard or to sort of, you know, rush around in a competitive...
What was that kind of joking comment people would make?
We pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. And, you know, it was a good joke because it was actually true. So there was all of that. But I think there were other sort of deeper cultural factors as well, which made for a different sense of time. A kind of, you know, valuing of intimacy and the kind of spontaneous encounter of, you know, talking late into the night around the...
Well, you said maybe people weren't as ambitious because there was no place to get to, or it was because, you know, your ambition was impeded in a sense.
Well, certainly, absolutely that, yes. I mean, there was kind of no incentive to competition or to kind of, you know, getting ahead in a kind of pressured and strenuous way.
I remember one Polish friend told me, he said what he missed about the communist days was that under communism, since no one had a phone, like Wednesday nights would be the night, you know, you'd go over to so-and-so's house and hang out, and Thursday night would be the night you'd go over to Susan's house and hang out, and it was just you didn't call, you just went. That's something that's inconceivable in Los Angeles society.
It has become just about inconceivable, hasn't it? Yes.
But Eva, you were also as a child, you write about Eva's beautiful memoir, Lost in Translation, which I really recommend as well. It's just a really beautiful book. You talk about being sensitive to time from a very early age, and I thought maybe you could read a passage from that.
This is, yes, from Krakow, clearly. I am walking home from school slowly, playing a game in which it is forbidden to step on the cracks between the slabstone squares of the pavement. The sun is playing its game of lines and shadows. Nothing happens. There is nothing but this moment in which I'm walking toward home, walking in time. But suddenly time pierces me with its sadness. This moment will not last. With every step I take, a sliver of time vanishes. Soon I'll be home, and then this nowness, will be the past, I think, and time seems to escape behind me like an invisible current being sucked into an invisible vortex. How can this be that this fullness, this me on the street, this moment which is perfectly abandoned, will be gone? It's like the time I broke a large porcelain doll, and no matter how much I wished it back to wholeness, it lay there on the floor in pieces. I can't do anything about this backward tug either. How many moments do I have in life? I hear my own breathing. With every breath, I'm closer to death. I slow down my steps. I'm not home yet, but soon I will be. Now I'm that much closer, but not yet, not yet, not yet. Remember this, I command myself, as if that way I could make some of it stay. When you're grown up, you will remember this, and you will remember how you told yourself to remember.
That's really beautiful. There's a book I was reading in conjunction of reading yours called The Parable of the Beast, where he talks about John Bleibtreu, one of the ways that we stop time as a child, or we mark it, is because we're seeing things for the first time. He talks about the accented moment, uh-huh. and that there are fewer and fewer of those, like the first time you saw a train, or the first time that doll uh-huh. broke, uh-huh. and it marks time in a specific way, right?
Yes, spots of time, as Wordsworth called them, you know, these kind of vivid moments in which there is kind of intense perception, which in a sense does make time pause, does sort of arrest time in a kind of plenitude, in a kind of vividness. Mm.
Because all those different ways we can think of time, I mean, we can think of, you know, when it feels, you talk about middle time being the most pleasurable time. And what do you mean by that? You know, when time is, you said it's not rushing and it's not slow, we have a sense of it, you get it right. What accounts for that?
Well, it is, you know, it is a bit mysterious, or it's rather, you know, elusive. But I think we all know that sort of sensations of pleasure and pain, or pleasure and discomfort, are very raveled up with our sense of internal pace and tempo. So that, you know, time goes fast when you're having fun, and time goes very slowly when you're anxiously waiting for some uncertain piece of news. I think perhaps, you know, in the psyche, in our kind of experiential time, there is this thing which is called tempo giusto, you know, the right kind of tempo, the right kind of pace, you know, within which we are comfortable and comfortably in the flow of time and in the flow of things. There is a Hungarian sociologist, a Hungarian-derived, who teaches at the University of Chicago, whose name I won't even attempt to pronounce. It's something like
Csikszentmihalyi.
Thank you very much.
Something like that.
That's excellent. Apparently his name, you know, is kind of customarily shortened to Chick by his colleagues. But anyway, but he has kind of developed this whole theory, which he has studied and kind of investigated, of flow. And flow is precisely the sensation of time moving at the right pace. And he thinks, you know, that we attain this condition of flow in very specific kinds of conditions. When we are engaged, when we're fully engaged in an activity, and when the activity feels self-justifying to us, feels important to us, and when the activity is challenging, but not so strenuous and not so difficult as to make us anxious. And in those conditions, he thinks we attain flow.
That's when you look up and it's night and you've forgot about time.
Well, precisely, yes, yes, yeah. Yes. Kind of the happiest way to be in time.
Now, you have a beautiful way of structuring this book, time in the body, time in the mind. And in the time in the body section, you talk about, it's an interesting phrase, the problematization of time, that there are these new pathologies of time that are kind of pathologies of our time, like attention deficit, which I love you say it's the decrease of tolerance for sustained units of time. So you talk about that and what computer time is doing, and sleep as a problematic site of morality. Could you talk about some of these problem areas that are affected by the new technologies?
And perhaps not only technologies, right. But other factors as well. But, you know, one of the things that fascinated me, one of the things that I wanted to discover as I set out to write this book, is whether there is such a thing as natural human temporality, as natural human time. And I found out that at every level of kind of, you know, of our functioning, bodily, mental, and I think psychological as well, time is quite malleable. I mean, certainly more malleable than for other species. And yet there are definite limits and parameters to human temporality, which are perhaps most evident on the biological level.
But could I make one sidebar there? Well, we'll come back to it about animals. No, go ahead. I want to remember.
Yeah. So, you know, on the biological level, I mean, you know, we know this in some ways completely empirically. You know, if our hearts beat too fast or too slow, then we get heart attacks or we collapse. You know, the 4-minute mile has not been bested by more than a few seconds, and we probably can never run a 2-minute mile unless we implant some microchips, you know, under our skin, unless we become not naturally human, not biologically human. And we're also, you know, very adjusted to the 24-hour cycle, like all species living on the planet. We're adjusted to the 24-hour cycle. And so, you know, one of the features of this, for example, is that we need sleep. and we need sleep at night rather than in the daytime. I mean, it makes a difference. And the reason it makes a difference is because of these internal biological clocks. Absolutely fascinating, you know, kind of internal mechanisms, which regulate the release of certain hormones, of certain chemical substances in our bodies. And certain chemical hormones and substances are released only at night, and others in the daytime. And the body really cannot be fooled, and time cannot be fooled.
And even I loved how you talked about our mental processes, what's happening on a cellular level in thought, you know, the transfer of chemicals across the synapses. I mean, there's a duration to that, so that when we speed things up, and God knows it happens to me all the time, as my husband will attest, you know, I'm just, you know, you can't actually think, because you have actually... You
yes,
haven't given
you've,
yourself
you've,
enough
you've
time.
You've kind of overreached the natural speed of the brain. I mean, the brain also has this measurable speed. You know, having a thought, having a perception takes a kind of minute but, you know, measurable quantum of time. And, I mean, I think, you know, that one of the ways in which technologies are affecting us is that we're becoming multitaskers. we're given to multitasking. We're given to kind of, you know, dispersing ourselves among several tasks at once. You know, we text while we listen to our iPod. You know, I don't know. We try to do many things at once, which these technologies seemingly enable us to do. But multitasking actually has very adverse effects, just like, you know, sleeping, just like not sleeping does. And one of the effects it has is that it actually diminishes the effectiveness of the brain. Over the long range, people who habitually multitask become worse at multitasking than people who don't. But in any one kind of instance of multitasking, the brain takes more time to shift from one activity, one category of activity to another. The brain is this fantastic encoding, you know, encoding mechanism, which has categories of perception and activity. And it takes more time for the brain to shift from one category of activity to another than to have continuous thoughts. And so, therefore, if we try to multitask, we actually end up doing things more slowly and less efficiently. So in our kind of, you know, keenness to sort of use time to the utmost and cram as much as possible into any one moment.
Stacking it up, you said, right?
Yeah. You know, in fact, very ironically, we become less efficient. We waste time.
We were just talking about that. Someone just told me about that new Mac. Bless Apple for coming up with this new app called Freedom.
Freedom, it's called Freedom.
Is anyone in here using it yet? It means you put it into your computer and it prevents you from getting on the internet. for specific periods of time. So you're like, today I'm going to try and go an hour. And then tomorrow maybe you can try 2 hours. I think it really is a brilliant idea.
It's a brilliant idea. That's apparently becoming a very popular device. I mean, you know, people.
You were also asking the question about the subjective environments of animals and, you know, what we can know about how animals and non-humans perceive time. And while I was reading your book, this book was reviewed in the New York Times about, it's called The Inside of a Dog. And I thought you would enjoy this. She writes, "For dogs, smell tells time. Perspective, scale, and distance are, after a fashion, in olfaction. But olfaction is fleeting. Odors are less strong over time, so strength indicates newness, weakness, age. The future is smelled on the breeze that brings air from the place you're headed. While we mainly look at the present, the dog's olfactory window onto the present is wider than our visual window, including not just the scene currently happening, but also a snatch of the just happened and the up ahead. The present has a shadow of the past and a ring of the future about it."
Well, that's a lovely intuition, but, you know, I would say that our present also always has the shadow of the past and a kind of intimation of the future. That, you know, this was, I mean, one of the kind of, one of the schools of philosophy which was particularly interested in time was called phenomenology, and this was precisely one of their basic metaphors, that our perception of time is like a perception of a melody, that we always have, you know, the note which is just passed in mind and a kind of, you know, intimation of the note ahead, that the present moment really cannot be just kind of cut out and sliced out of the continuum of time.
And when were those phenomenologists mainly doing that work? I mean, what provoked that examination of time? Do you know?
Well, it was the beginning of the 20th century, which was a great period for the examination of consciousness and human subjectivity altogether. Mm. You know, so that before that, time was thought to have a kind of objective existence, you know, out there. And I do think there is a kind of external time that exists on its own, but they started kind of theorizing that time is created through our perceptions, through our subjectivities, through our consciousness.
You noted that Einstein himself needed 10 hours of sleep, as someone who thought a lot about, I thought that was quite... could you talk a little bit about the mental disorders that are? I thought it was very interesting the way you looked at things that I hadn't thought of before as disorders of time, depression, obviously attention deficit, but some of the other things that we don't think of. I never thought of them in terms of so many of our anxieties about time affect our behavior in such profound ways.
It is, you know, it is quite clear that in extreme states of mental disturbance or mental malaise, time becomes very distorted. So that, you know, in depression, time seems to move twice as slowly as in sort of, you know, more regular, more normal states. In mania, time kind of hurtles along at a kind of galloping speed. In schizophrenia, I mean, it is hard to fathom, but there is often an almost complete severance from real time, so that to a schizophrenic patient, a schizophrenic patient may feel that an hour has passed when actually a day has gone by, or that a day has passed when actually a week has gone by, a kind of complete sort of separation of time from perception. And the usual kind of, you know, way of thinking about it in psychoanalysis and psychiatry has been that affective disorders, that emotional disorders, cause these disturbances of time. But it is now thought more and more, and I really believe that this is true, that if our kind of temporality, if our cultural, social temporality is sufficiently disturbed, then, you know, these mental, these psychological discomforts follow. And, you know, certainly it's very interesting, I think, that the kind of central new disorder of our time is attention deficit disorder, because that is a disorder which absolutely mimics this kind of digital temporality that we live in. It is a kind of intolerance of anything but sort of very brief durations of time, intolerance, impatience, kind of intolerance of delay, and a kind of fragmentation of attention, you know, dispersion of attention, as if the multitasking were built into the psyche in a way.
Well, it's also our, I mean, and that lack of attention, I mean, it's very hard. I mean, you talk, I mean, your passages about sitting around the table in Poland or in your life, the intimacy that can be so lacking in today's society that we don't really value so much just hanging out, you know, just sitting and being with people and talking with people and giving other people our attention. That's precisely. So hard to come by.
Well, precisely, and I think, you know, that as many parents, you know, live increasingly harassed lives and, in fact, increasingly fragmented lives, that giving attention to children is becoming increasingly difficult. And children, above all, you know, children with their very malleable, you know, still unformed psyches, are absolutely formed by the relationships with others and by the attention of others. It is really needed as a kind of framework, you know, for structuring the psyche, for becoming sort of calm or otherwise. And so I sometimes think, you know, that the deficit of attention belongs to the parents as much as to the children.
So when we come to the Q&A, I noticed there's some students here, you digital natives, will want to hear from you on your thoughts on this. There's definitely a digital divide here for those of us who didn't grow up with all these devices, you know, that were available to us, and those who did. But you end the book with a very powerful critique, and I wanted to have you read something at the end, but if you could, maybe you can just talk about it a little bit. First, the phrase you said, you talk about the ethos of conspicuous exertion. I thought that was a pretty marvelous phrase. You say, we seem to be driven by being driven. And that really struck me. I mean, that sense of, you know that there's no downtime, and it's even hard to stop and think about it, you know, or to notice that there's no downtime.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, you know, for one thing, we live in these 24/7 societies, and especially in big cities, we live absolutely in 24/7 environments in which we can, you know, shop till we drop till all hours of the night. We can do many things, you know, through the day and through the night. There really is no time out and no downtime. You know, or even, you know, in the night, we, you know, I mean, stockbrokers in New York can contact their, you know, stockbrokers in Bombay into the Bombay morning. We can Twitter our news into Brazil, you know, in real time.
What was that anecdote you gave? You called a friend, where was she? She was in a...
Yes, I'm based largely in London these days, and so I was calling a friend who I thought was in London, on the other side of London, which is, you know, far enough away. But when she picked up her, you know, her mobile phone, there were these sounds of these very agitated, rather violent sounds in the background. And she was in Peshawar in Pakistan. And there was a riot going on behind her, as it happened. And so she answered quite calmly. But, you know, I had stepped into this kind of micro slice of somebody else's history and a completely different historical continuum. And then I stepped back out of it. So, but you know, this is another thing which is actually quite astonishing if we think about
it,
is that, you know, time is kind of now separated from the geographical territory in which we're located. So that's interesting, you know, too. So we really don't have, I mean, in a sense, you know, our temporal space is very crowded, extremely crowded. And another, you know, very interesting kind of fact is that we work harder now than we have throughout much of the 20th century. I mean, certainly sort of middle-class professionals work longer hours than, you know, than people.
What's the dictionary definition of leisure is unengaged time.
Yes, or discretionary time, or completely free time. And it really seems that we have less of that.
Well, it has to be an act of will, right, to take that time, or to own that time, or to step
absolutely.
Away, and it's harder and harder to do that.
Absolutely.
Music is one of the ways that you talk about, in a sense, being able to cope with this overload or cope with time. I mean, that's been so in your own life as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I find music, you know, a kind of great nourishment and sustenance. And I, you know, I mean, music above all the arts is kind of the time-shaping art. I mean, in a sense, it is the shaping of time.
Well, you talk about the rhythm of, you know, the transmission to the infant. I mean, that rhythm is really the first way we encounter.
Yes,
a sense of time, or having to knowing that time exists because someone's going to go away and you don't know when they will come back. And
yes, absolutely. I mean, I think this is a very important insight of psychoanalysis, is that our sense of time is also formed through our early relationships with others, and I think very much through sort of bodily rhythms and the rhythms of the language that the infant hears, the rhythms of the music, of lullabies. It is the first form of communication, and I think accounts for different kinds of cultural temporalities, you know, different kinds of music, different kinds of language, different bodily paces, I think as well. And then, yes, I think, you know, the sense of time develops through relationships as well. I mean, you know, one of the things that the young child has to learn is precisely to tolerate a kind of delay, to tolerate the absence of the parents, and then to tolerate, you know, longer units of that, to contain time within itself, in a sense.
Eva, you are such a great interdisciplinarian. You use so many different sources, and you seem so undaunted by, you know, the scientific literature. I mean, everything from, is this book a departure for you in terms of approaching that way, or is this often how you work in nonfiction?
I suppose I have addressed a variety of subjects, and I like to keep myself interested. Actually, science, oddly enough, played quite an important part in my first novel, The Secret, which is a somewhat futuristic novel, but it's a plausible future. So I first started, you know, doing research on science then, but I mean, you know, it seems to me that science nowadays is taking on the classical philosophical questions.
Yes,
you
is.
Know,
it is.
Biology, neurobiology. You know, what is consciousness?
What is death? I mean, you talked about the science. Is it an evolutionary biologist who was addressing that as why we the need for mortality in terms of evolution, which was also very interesting.
Yes, he actually wasn't an evolutionary biologist, but you know, he was studying life cycles. Yeah. So what is death? You know, what is the relationship of mind and body? All of these classical questions are being addressed in these newly precise ways and through actual investigations.
Because the storyteller, as Walter Benjamin wrote, you know, the job of the storyteller was always to remind us of our mortality, and now, in a sense, the scientists are taking that on as well. But I love how you talk about the section in here on mortality is very beautiful, and you talk about the poignancy, you know, the tenderness that is brought out by loss and by confrontation with mortality as we age. I thought that was very, very beautiful.
Thank you. Well, you know, this is one of the things that we do have to accept, I think, you know, that we have to come to terms with, and in accepting the passage of time and accepting the sense of the future, we have to accept that.
And do you think it is a reason why there is more of a turn towards religion? There's towards fundamentalism, and in terms of People wanting to reassert control over time. You talk about, you know, praying five times a day in Islam, or keeping Shabbat, or, I mean, these regular rhythms of time, which in our secular lives we don't have.
Yes. Well, of course, religions were founded to a great extent precisely in order to help us cope with mortality. But also, yes, I think, you know, the sense of ritualization of time is very important. And I think, that there is a kind of reaction in some parts of the world. There is a kind of reaction against precisely the kind of very dispersed, very flat kind of time that we live in, time which is not marked by ritual.
Just computer clicks.
That's it.
Open Facebook. Open it. Facebook again. Would you read the last section of the book? And I want to give people here a time to ask questions of Eva. So would you like to read a little bit?
Yes. We are in astonishing ways temporal creatures. Our bodies are their own timers. We take in time through our minds and senses, and we create time shapes within us. But beyond that, the problem of time is inseparable from that of meaning. Time is the fundamental medium and condition of human meanings. It is the finitude of that element which is the ground of all existential quandaries. We think against the horizon of mortality and contemplate first questions against the knowledge of our own ending. What are the uses of a finite life, and what uses do we want to make of it? Time places a limiting condition not only on our lifespan, but on the ideology of will and the illusion of total control. In a thoughtful book entitled Timescapes of Modernity, The Environment and Invisible Hazards, Barbara Adam argues that the depredations we have visited on the environment have followed from our denial of nature's temporality, the hidden slow processes of growth and decay, the long-term effects of oil spills or deforestation. We know the damage our exploitations of nature have wrought. But if we overexploit our own human temporality, we risk similarly tearing and degrading the experiential fabric. Technology and new knowledge can bring us more health and longer lives, more options and more instant gratifications. But if we use ourselves instrumentally and do not cultivate the subterranean strata of the self, if we do not take care because we believe we will live forever, and if we try to pack all moments with digital quanta, then we run the danger of laying waste or killing the time that is given to us. In the Faustian bargains we try to strike with time, that would be the most ironic price of all. At least from my admittedly anthropomorphic perspective, so it seems to me. The workings of time in ourselves are imperceptible, but we need to recognize and respect both its parameters and our own temporal limits if, in our rush to post-natural modes of existence, we do not want to lose a rich and deep measure of our humanity.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. So we will open up to questions from you. What nagging questions about time? I think there's someone right there, Libby.
I'm curious if, through your knowledge gained and study of time and some of the effects, like you talked about multitasking on the brain, if it's caused you to adjust how you spend your time?
Has it caused me to adjust? Actually, yes. I mean, I think it has caused me to understand that I need to slow down occasionally, and also not to feel, guilty about, taking time to sort of mull things over, to muse on things, to take time out, in a sense, to take time out to reflect on things, to process experience, to know what one has experienced.
Mulling and musing, very underrated activities.
I think so, actually. Yes, I would like to recommend them.
There's a mic for you.
Oh, thank you very much. Actually, do I have the time to develop an anti-anthropomorphic perspective in the sense that...
How long do you need?
Eternity. Actually, is there such a thing as time? Because it seems to me that time is just a measuring mechanism located in human subjectivity. There are events, and we differentiate events using time. So time is not a thing. It's simply something we use. So for example, if one is in solitary confinement for a long period of time, or in solitary confinement, and one doesn't know when the meal comes through a small window, then one would lose sense of time. So time is not ever present. It's something that we use to measure events.
Well, I think, you know, that time has two guises. I mean, there is the external time, the time of the cosmos, I'm not in a position to understand, and whether it is an existent thing or not, you know, we don't know, and also it can move in many directions, including, you know, backwards, apparently. But there is for us, it is not a thing. It is not a thing, but it is an element. It is perhaps like air, and we're not conscious of air until we're deprived of it. or it is perhaps like, yes, I mean, well, perhaps air is the closest analogy. No, it is not concrete, it is not three-dimensional, and yet it is absolutely the medium of our existence, and it affects us, you know, very profoundly.
And when you use that example of, you said, being locked or confined in a... Because you do talk about that experiment where students were... where was it? How did they let them do it to them? But they were kept in a dark, you know...
Yes.
And it's biological time as well. You revert to the 24-hour...
Yes,
right?
Actually, yes. Well, the 25-hour, but that's a detail. But the thing is that, you know, if you are in a kind of, you know, sensory deprivation environment, you lose track of time. But that is an incredibly discomforting condition. It can make people go mad after a while. So we actually need to orient ourselves in time. There is the, you know, specific terrestrial time that we are adjusted to. And we need this orientation.
Back there?
In your book, do you talk about sleep and the way sleep may affect our perception of time or the quality of our time?
Yes, I talk about sleep quite a bit because it's actually a very fascinating subject, I think. And, you know, perhaps one of the things to say is that we know as a society, we suffer from sleep pathologies quite a bit, and all the advanced countries do. But sleep is really very necessary. I mean, I think we tend to think of sleep as a time in which, you know, nothing happens, as a kind of waste of time, which I think is partly why we suffer from sleep pathologies. But in fact, sleep is completely necessary in this adjustment to the 24-hour cycle. But also certain kinds of things happen in sleep. So that, for example, there is something which was recently identified called sleep spindles, which is these bursts of, you know, neurological activity in the brain, in which the brain kind of resorts and reorganizes information it has received and actually embeds certain information in deeper strata of memory. So that in absolutely kind of pragmatic ways, if we learn something in a day, if we, let us say, take a violin lesson or learn how to ride a bike, and do not sleep, this will not be embedded in our memory. If we do sleep, it actually, you know, becomes a part of us, and pretty soon we can do it, you know, fairly automatically and without thinking much about it. So that's, yes, that's one level. And I think, you know, I think Freud was right that, you know, that a lot of our affective lives, our inner lives, also get resorted and processed and kind of worked out during the night, and the processing comes out in dreams. So,
How about over here? This gentleman right there.
You said music is a good way to coping with time. What other things are good with coping with time? Exercise or?
Well, I think we need to learn how to. Negotiate with time, and how to pattern time, in some way which feels both. Useful and comfortable. I mean, I think certain kinds of activities are best done very efficiently. Taking money out of a money machine rather than standing in a queue is a much better option. I mean, some activities are lend themselves to kind of, you know, efficiency. But I think that if we press ourselves in all of our activities and in all of our dimensions of life to be efficient, then we lose certain dimensions of experience. And, you know, how we regain that, I think, is a matter of, you know, personal negotiations. Taking a long walk and kind of thinking about things is, you know, perhaps one way to do it. You know, listening to music or reading, I think, is another way to do it.
But there are qualities of those things, say, taking a walk and being alone with yourself, which could be taking a walk and not talking on the phone.
Yes, I think that's definitely a condition of this.
Try it.
Yeah.
Back there, there's two back there.
I have a friend that often says whenever you ask him what time it is, he'll say, well, you know, it's 10 till 8, later than it's ever been, which I guess in a cosmological sense is true. But in the way that you're talking about time, it's almost as if it's interchangeable with another four-letter word, life. Uh-huh. Are they completely interchangeable in your world?
Well, no. There are other aspects of life, but I think, you know, that our patterning of time, our deployment of time is absolutely fundamental to, in fact, to what we want to do with our lives, to what we think is important, to our sense of purposes. It's very fundamental. Yes, I mean, it is, you know, it is the medium through which we construct our meanings. But it is a definite medium, I mean, you know, separate from other things, I think, as these kinds of changes in lived time demonstrate. I mean, you know, we can use time in very different ways, and different cultures use it in very different ways.
Thank you. Why does it appear that time goes faster as we get older?
Well, first of all, because we're used to absorbing larger chunks of time, so we know how long a year is. A child has no idea how long a year is, or initially how long an hour is. So, you know, it all seems to kind of stretch, you know, unpredictably, and each moment is, you know, has its own kind of weight. And also, I suppose we know we have less of it. but I'm not even sure that that is always completely true. I mean, I know that that is one of the kinds of things that are often said, but I think for adolescents, you know, often time seems to hurtle along at great speed, for example.
Over here?
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about appassionata, about how the dire circumstances of the world impact the artist and challenge the artist in that whole relationship.
It will be a bit difficult to answer this question because I would have to kind of explain the novel. Appassionata is a recent novel of mine, and it is very much about music and about a pianist who lives very much in the music and who becomes involved with somebody who is a Chechen nationalist and kind of fervent nationalist, and who increasingly turns to violence. And this eventually causes in her a kind of creative crisis. She stops being able to play because she doesn't know what sort of the role of art is, the importance of art is in the face of this violence and of a violent world. Eventually, she comes to reclaim the meaning of art. And actually, I think, you know, it's not unrelated. I mean, that I think, you know, one of the reasons that music is so nurturing and so encompassing, and I think so palpably affecting, is because it shapes time in these complex ways. I mean, in ways which are as complex as time is in our subjective lives. But what she, you know, comes to think is that it is the complexity of art, it is the subtlety of art, it is that art takes into account, you know, not only aggression and rage, but other aspects of human life, of human nature, tenderness and acceptance and compassion. It is for those reasons that it is important. Music, by the way, I just want to say it, you know, because I think it is so interesting. Music has actually therapeutic effects, physiologically as well as psychologically. So that, for example, it can help Parkinson's patients organize their movements. For people with dementia, it is often the last thing that they remember and that brings them back into the world and that means something. And I think, you know, this organization of time is very important.
I used to feel like when I'd go on vacation, like I really got away because it was like I would come home and to my apartment and it was like time had stood still and I had been away and things were moving. But now with like internet and cell phones and ATMs, it's like it's so easy to get money. I used to have to really plan my money and, you know, traveler's checks, and I used to be able to be in a foreign country and I would be oblivious to what was going on in the world because everything was in a language I couldn't understand. Now it's just so easy to get news, and I just find I don't get away. That concept of getting away and going on vacation, that is just really hard to find, and I think it's really necessary.
Well, yes, I agree. I mean, vacations can seem like very hard work, and you know, we're very rarely unplugged. And I think we do need to get unplugged from time to time. You know, we really do. We need that different kind of time. I mean, not only time out, but a different kind of time—a time to be with experience, with others, with ourselves in a different way. But I agree, it is harder to get. And, you know, by the way, I think, you know, it means, I mean, if we're so bombarded with information and with quantities of stimulus and information, that it's often very difficult to make sense of the information that we're getting. So actually, that is a kind of waste of time, too. You know, if we try to sort of, you know, absorb 100 pieces of information in an hour, we probably don't absorb any of them.
So what's the, I remember what the statistic was on how much, compared to what Shakespeare read in his day of, you know, how much news would come in. Yes. I mean, with us, it's like within every hour or something. And the endless nature of it, too, that because of the internet, things are connected to other things, which then lead you to other things, which is kind of magical and at the same time, yes, you know, maddening.
Yes.
It really is. So you never get finished.
That's right. That's right. And you know, certain...
Right here.
Yeah.
Right there, you had your hand up.
You were talking about sleep and dreams and things like that. And I was wondering, you know, sometimes I have those dreams where it seems like days pass at a time, but I've only been asleep for 3 hours. Or if you've been asleep for 8 hours and it feels like you just went to sleep 5 minutes ago, is there an explanation for that, of like time perception while you're dreaming or something?
Well, you know, Freud famously said that there is no time in the unconscious, and you know that when we dream out of the unconscious to a large extent. You know, but in our psyche altogether, I think, you know, time stretches and, you know, intervals between the past and the present are often conflated, and particularly when our consciousness, when our alert minds are not awake, I think that sort of, you know, sense of time becomes into operation.
And then when we're conscious, you use that phrase in the book, heterochrony?
Heterochrony, yes. I mean, that the time inside ourselves is very heterogeneous, that there are different kinds of time which exist within us. And I think we all know that kind of, that occasionally we can travel between, you know, our childhood and the present moment in a second, or we can kind of revert to, you know, memories of childhood or more childish states, or that, you know, from the perspective of the present, we can remember something differently than we did before, etc. I mean, time within the psyche really is very malleable and not sort of, you know, subject to chronological laws.
Let's take a couple more questions, one here and one there.
I think that lady has been trying to
ask. Okay.
With respect to how long it takes for a human child to grow up and the time compared to some other species, but it seems that kids are growing up faster now, or they're being forced to grow up faster by merchandising, and also the cultural aspect of having, when does a child mature enough, how much time do they need to grow up, and compared in the United States to Europe. Could you comment on the maturity of, say, teenagers and young adults in Europe as opposed to what's happening in the United States?
Well, this is, you know, this is very complicated, and the periodicity of childhood and adolescence have varied so much in various cultures. But I think that what slightly concerns me is that I think that this particular kind of time, which is the time of childhood, is being lost as children are being, you know, driven to more and more activities, you know, to more and more kind of improving activities. And as they are kind of, you know, living in this kind of digital surround in which they also don't have this time to muse or to let their imaginations run free or to be bored. I mean, all of these things are
important
to childhood.
Yes.
They're important to childhood, and they're actually, you know, it turns out, developmentally important. I mean, it is when children imagine things, you know, posit things, begin to kind of notice the world for themselves. So I think that that kind of childhood time is being lost, or, you know, at least there is a concern that it is lost. Yes, I mean, you know, in different historical periods, there were times when there was no adolescence. I mean, adolescence is a relatively recent invention, and particularly a kind of, you know, Western invention, and particularly the American invention. Adolescence is a kind of very specific stage of life. So there have been great varieties of these patterns.
Right here. This will be our last question.
You mentioned time as an entity rather than as something concrete. I wonder, though, if you'd like to say something about the clock, which is a much older technology than those that we're dealing with now. But the clock commands our day very, very importantly. We're bound by the clock. That's a very, very important aspect, of a concrete aspect of time to which we're bound. We only have to look at last Sunday when the clocks went back, and most of us were terribly and utterly confused for the rest of the day. We are very much affected by the clock as a concrete measurement of our time.
Well, absolutely. You know, in the introduction of the clock, initially in the 14th century, seemed to people a kind of great revolution. You know, that before the introduction of the clock, I mean, people lived more on what is called, you know, event time or sort of natural time. I mean, they sort of pace their activities to sunset and sunrise, and you know, just stages of the observable stages of the day. So that the clock, the regularization of time by the clock, initially also made people very uncomfortable. But of course, you know, clocks and clock time and chronological time and the regularized kind of time zones have been very necessary and very important to everything we live with now. You know, the whole Industrial Revolution, you know, scheduling of trains, etc., etc. Yes, I mean, people used to talk about the tyranny of the clock. you know, it also enables us to plan and to organize our time. Yeah, I mean, it's very much a part of our lives. You know, and I think, you know, certain kinds of activities do need to be planned. We do need a kind of realistic organization of time. Mm.
And the time has come. We work in a certain interval of time for these events, and I think you can see from Eva's book that it's really a fascinating journey. It really makes you think about time in all kinds of interesting and ways that you hadn't before. It's just a delight to have you here, Eva. Thank you so much for coming. And Eva will be signing in the lobby.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.